progesterone blood level is low. I'm Dr. Valerie Davidson from Progress Your Health.
And I'm Dr. Robert Mackey from Progress Your Health. If you can tell, if you're watching this on YouTube, this is our second official video with our new setup. We got, three cameras in the room. I'm looking at a camera there. You're looking at a camera right next to me, and we have another shot over there. I think it's pretty cool.
Oh, I think it's awesome, except I don't know what camera to look at.
Yeah, right. Yeah, well, maybe we just won't look at the camera. You and I will just talk about a question. We have one from Kendra today. This one came in through, again, Ask the Doctor. We appreciate that. She's actually from Monroe, Washington. We changed her name, of course, so there's no identifying information, but she is from Monroe. She doesn't realize, though, but we actually used to live in Carnation right down the street on a little lake there called Lake Joy, which she'll know where that is. Nobody else knows where that is, but she'll certainly know where that is. Now you and I are actually back in Bellingham now. We actually like it up here.
No, I love Bellingham. Granted, when we were in Carnation, that was really nice, too. Or we were, because Monroe is right next to Carnation, so we were really close. We probably could have been neighbors.
It's not that. When you're driving, from Carnation to Monroe, it's a little bit of a drive. Ways, yeah. So Monroe, Duval, Carnation, and you get into like the east side, like Issaquah and Redmond, and all those places. It was really nice little area. Mm-hmm. It's kind of away from you're close to the city, but you're away from the city. Mm-hmm. So why don't we go ahead and read Kendra's question? We'll just dive right in.
All right. So, hello. I have so many questions. When talking about progesterone numbers in your podcast, are you referring to nanograms per deciliter or nanograms per milliliter? Also, if serum progesterone is consistently less than 0.5 nanograms per milliliter, 16 hours post 200 milligrams oral, is that an indication someone may need to dose twice daily to protect the uterine lining? I've seen so many people say that progesterone only stays in your body about 12 hours. I take 200 milligrams oral progesterone at 8:30 p.m. every evening in order to test my estradiol biased cream applied at 8:30 in the morning. My labs are always taken around 12:30 p.m., and my progesterone on the last three labs has never been above 0.7, and that would be nanograms per milliliter. I know that you've said the level should be around 1.5 to 2.5 the next morning, so not sure if I did my labs 12 hours post-dose, if that would make a difference, but I'm concerned that maybe I'm not holding sufficient progesterone during a 24-hour period.
Well, this is a little trick that when you are testing someone's progesterone level, when they're taking oral progesterone like she is, that number should almost always be greater than one as opposed to less than one for a menopausal woman, of course, right? So what do you think about Kendra's question?
Well, I think like she was saying here that she took it at 8:30 and then she didn't have her blood test until 12:30, around noontime the next day. That's probably a little long to test it because truly when you're taking the oral progesterone at night, it can make you sleepy. So you don't necessarily want it to stay in your system too much the next morning, but you have to have a little so that you can ensure that you're absorbing enough to protect that uterine lining. So there's probably a timing issue here, or it could also be maybe a sustained release versus an instant release.
Yeah, right. So whether it is a progesterone, bioidentical progesterone, sustained release from a compounding pharmacy, or if it's an instant release Prometrium from a big box pharmacy. So what would you expect there? Let's just say, comparing those two, I would expect that the instant release would be in and out really quick, right? So her blood level would look like this, where if it was sustained release, it potentially would, which we would hope it would last a little bit longer.
And that is true. But I will say even with the patients that I have that I use an instant release, and that's usually because that sustained release was too high. Like the next morning, their progesterone was at 12 or in the teens. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, that's a little too high for the morning. Right. That's why you're feeling groggy. So let's switch you to an instant release. I still want it to be over one.
Yeah, right.
So I do feel like the 0.7, but I have a feeling looking at this because progesterone 200 milligrams, that's a good dose. That's a good dose of oral progesterone. It's probably the timing.
Yeah, right. Yeah, she takes it at 8:30 at night. She goes to the lab 12:30 the next day. Like you said, that's a 16-hour wait time. It'd be interesting if she went to the lab, you know, first thing in the morning, maybe not worry too much about the bias, just to solve this one issue, mm-hmm. to see what that blood level is roughly 12 hours later.
Oh, yeah, that's a great idea.
You know, or a little bit, even a little shorter if you can do mm-hmm. it. Take it a little bit later at night and then go to the lab first thing in the morning, so it's as short amount of time as possible without, you know, being able to sleep off the progesterone, right?
Yeah.
Not taking it first thing in the morning, because then she'd probably be, you know, fall asleep at the wheel or something on the way to the lab.
Oh, you mean take? Oh, yeah. I wouldn't recommend Kendra take progesterone orally, or anyone take progesterone orally in the morning, because it can make you a little tired.
Sure. And that's one of the reasons why we use the oral, is because
at
of
night,
that fact.
Yeah,
yeah, right. So you think it's just more of a timing issue, because 200 milligrams, we very rarely, if ever, go above 200 milligrams. So her question, taking it twice a day, 200 in the morning and 200 at night, a little overkill.
She would be tired.
Sure.
She would automatically know that too. I tried that 200 in the morning. Ooh, I got tired, you know, or groggy, or, you know, too relaxed. But you said something really interesting that she, because I love how she's very particular. So Kendra is like, okay, I take this at 8:30 at night.
Sure.
I take this exactly 8:30 in the morning. So I like that she's got that routine, which is really nice. So if she didn't want to break up that routine and take her progesterone closer to midnight, or taking her estrogen in the morning a little bit earlier to get a little bit of a shorter window there, is she could just go and, you know, take her progesterone at 8:30 and then just, you know, don't worry about testing her estrogen the next day, put it on as you normally would, and then just check that progesterone, you know, in the morning, like around 8 o'clock, mm-hmm. 8 to 9 o'clock in the morning, after she's taken it at 8:30 prior that night, the night before, and then see if that progesterone is over one. And I bet you it probably would be.
Yeah, yeah. And it'd probably be even a little higher than that. It'd probably be closer to, you know, 2, 2.5, 3, 4. It probably wouldn't get above 5, even though, yeah, to 200 milligrams, I mean, you see quite a variance of numbers when they're taking 200 milligrams. Usually when it's 100 milligrams, you don't see it too high. But when they take 200, you know, you get a group of women and you look at all their numbers, and they're kind of all over the place a little bit. Some have really good numbers, some have really low numbers. But as you said, as long as they're taken orally, it's usually always greater than one.
Yeah, exactly. So, and I do have some women that are maybe on 100 and it still looks like they're on that sustained release. It's a little too high in the morning. That's why they're pressing snooze a couple of times. And so we switch it to the instant release. But either way, I would just have, like I said, I think it's more of a timing issue, but I love that she's concerned about her uterine lining.
Sure.
We don't want to disregard that. If there was really, there's a couple of things with that. So if we were really concerned about it, especially if she were spotting, then absolutely there's something where we need to balance out that progesterone, raise it up, or balance out that estrogen. But if she were concerned, you know, a lot of women, we just do a quick transvaginal ultrasound, look in there, measure the size of the uterus, uterine lining, and that's really easy. So that would be one way for her to feel like, okay, I'm not putting my uterus at risk. And then another thing that I think is interesting on this question is I would love to know her bias dose. Because if it's very low, then we know that progesterone is probably, 200 is probably protective.
Right.
If it's pretty high, or maybe doing a 50-50 ratio, or there's more estradiol in there, then we might say, okay, well, then we want to just make sure that progesterone is enough to be protective. So it's probably more that bias dose.
Because if her dose, let's just say hypothetically, just from what we've seen on the podcast and people sending in their questions, let's say her bias dose is 1 to 3 milligrams, 200 milligrams of progesterone is going to be more than sufficient. But let's say her dose is above 5, right? You get into that, you know, that, and I wouldn't even say 5 is really all that high of a dose. Certainly you can go higher than that. I think that would sort of dictate. And honestly, you know, to her point, you know, trying to protect the uterine lining, no spotting or bleeding, you're sort of flying blind a little bit, right? You don't really know what's happening in there. Uterine cancer is not going to develop in a few months, maybe not even in a few years. But you know, the longer you go, the more potential risk there is. So I know we talked about this on another episode before. Women go in every year for a Pap smear, which screens them for cervical cancer. Don't you think that a new transition or a new part of women's health they should be doing, especially the popularity of HRT, that they should be doing an annual transvaginal ultrasound for the same reason?
Oh, yeah, I definitely think that'd be a great idea. I do notice some of my patients, when they go in for their exam, that they, there's a few things going on here. So of course, postmenopausal women, Now they're changing the guidelines about how often to have a pap smear. It's not every year. So they wouldn't be going in every year to get a pap smear. They might, before they changed it to maybe every 3 years, or if you have a new partner, a sexual partner, then you want to have a pap smear.
Well, isn't it for some that are even changed it to like every five?
Some of them say you don't even ever have to have one again.
Right. So where do you think that is it a monogamous relationship, or they're at a certain point in their life? Where do you fall on that, at least on the pap smear side?
Well, I definitely think if you have a new partner, because when they're doing that certain, you know, checking for cervical cancer, that can come from HPV, which you can get, and there's, you know, you can get from another partner, and you can't test men for that. So I do think, so it might even be that, you know, she's not necessarily needing a exam, or it might be every 3 years or every 5 years. So she would just need to be sent in for a transvaginal ultrasound.
Instead of.
Yeah. So, and that's what we do too. If we have, you know, just every once in a while, I might say, or if they're feeling crampy or we're not sure if the doses or whatnot is, I'll just, you know, write them up a rec to go down to the local radiology department and get a transvaginal ultrasound, usually in and out, and it's pretty easy.
Yeah, right. Especially for a case like Kendra's, when you're sort of worried about something and you're taking HRT, the whole point is not to be worried, right? Because I don't really think, especially if you're at a fairly low bias dose, I don't really think there's a lot to worry about as far as risk factors, you know, or potential cancer risk. But the fact that she's concerned about it, if she did have an annual transvaginal ultrasound, it sort of gives peace of mind and eliminates that potential problem.
No, absolutely. I agree. Even with the thyroid, we work with a lot of thyroid patients sometimes, especially if they're more Hashimoto's necessarily, I would want to get like a quick little thyroid ultrasound.
Sure.
You know, you can, so just ultrasound.
I know that there's a lot of attention put on the nodules. What do you think about, and a whole nother subject, what do you think about ultrasound for thyroid, monitoring thyroid nodules?
Oh, I think that's a great idea. If you're going to have nodules, you want a family of nodules. That's less risk, you know, looking at cancer. One nodule is a little more suspicious than having a few of them, but you know, monitoring them. I do that every once in a while too, and follow that along.
There's an idea there that those nodules are going to turn into cancer, which I don't really think is all that quite accurate. Like you said, multiple nodules is actually pretty normal. You know, what, 10 to 15%, maybe 15% plus is going to have multiple nodules. But one nodule, I think, is a little bit more suspicious. And if it's growing over time, you know, if they stay pretty stable. But it's interesting about the pap smear. A lot of women, they go into their, you know, for their annual, you know, they just think of it as kind of like this routine they do every year. And I don't know really, based on what you said, I don't think that pap smear itself really provides a tremendous amount of information or a lot of value, which is why now they're changing the guidelines, obviously.
Yeah, sometimes on there, your pap smear say like, endocervical cells were present, so you know, or they'll be a little, or they'll even get a little spotting on there, and they'll notice there's some uterine cells there. Mm-hmm. Like I said, the endocervical cells or uterine cells, and they'll say, oh, maybe it's thick. We should do an ultrasound. So sometimes it can give you some information. I think pap smears are good. They'll tell you if you have parabasal cells, because parabasal cells are immature vaginal cells. So then that tells us, oh, this woman, she's postmenopausal, she's got parabasal cells. It'll say predominantly parabasal cells on the, when you read the information on a pap smear and, you know, the results on a pap smear, and that'll tell us that, oh, she probably has some atrophy, because you have the immature vaginal cells, they need the estrogen to grow up to become mature vaginal cells. So that tells me, oh, we might want to do maybe a little estriol to kind of, you know, help with that atrophy. And usually they'll know too, like, yeah, it's a little dry down there.
Yeah, so I was just going to ask you that too. So if those are showing up on a pap smear, then you would expect her to have some type of symptoms of some sort.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had a patient the other day. She went to go get a pap smear, and she hadn't had one in a while. And her new doctor, who sounded great, was like, oh yes, it's a little, what was the word? A menopausey down here. I was like, what a great adjective. It's a little menopausey here. And I'm like, well, we can work on that.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. That's for the most part, that's something that's relatively common, a little estriol, you know, sort of solves the issue. We've talked about that in other episodes where we don't use, at least ourselves, we don't use estradiol, even though estradiol is the only thing FDA approved, quote unquote. We don't use estradiol vaginally. Now, everyone says that it's fine, it's safe, but it's just sort of our preference that we decide to use estriol only and don't either mix the two or use any estradiol.
Yeah, exactly, because the estradiol can stimulate, what is it, the alpha or the beta receptors in the uterine lining, and then that can cause a thickening. I know you're not using it that often if women are using it vaginally, so they say that it's not going to have an effect, but I have had women have some spotting using estradiol vaginally.
Sure. I've had some women spot with even using estriol, you know, vaginally. Not that often, but, you know, it does happen, you know, occasionally here or there. I couldn't imagine what using estradiol would do if they're sensitive to the estriol. So Kendra's question, it's really more of a timing issue and potentially what the bias dose is. Those are the two things to sort of pay attention to there. It'd be really nice to know. Always know what that bias dose is.
Maybe because Kendra, even though we changed your name, you probably know that we're talking about you. So tell us what your dose is. And then also too, because I know she asked about the units. So we always use the nanograms slash milliliters.
Per milliliter, yeah. Mm-hmm. Nanogram per milliliter. She's the first one that has ever asked. She must have a little bit of a medical background, mm-hmm. or she's just really into the numbers because she's the only person that has ever asked about units, right? Usually we just talk about the numbers and leave the units off, which I think the units, every lab has their, at least in America anyways, has the pretty standard units for depending on what test. Are you looking at all the cameras?
I don't know what camera to look at.
there's a monitor behind over here, and there's a computer there, and there's sort of a lot going on right now. As you can see, my hand just went in front of the other camera. That's a little wild, but it's a fun little new toy. It's really great to play with. Do we have anything else to say about Kendra's situation?
I would say don't take it twice a day. It's the nanograms per milliliter is what we're looking at. And it's probably just some timing. So maybe the next time, Kendra, you go and get your blood work done, try to make it a little more like 12 hours and then write back and let us know what your results are.
Yeah. Oh, one thing I was going to say, what about, I know that you were doing a newsletter recently and you're writing about some genetic stuff, cytochrome P450 SNPs, mm-hmm. SNPs, SNP, so singulate nucleotide polymorphism.
Yeah, say that five times.
Yeah, SNPs. SNP, singulate nucleotide polymorphism. So the one everybody knows, of course, is the MTHFR, right? That's the mother effergene that has an impact on your methylation and your folate metabolism. You were doing some recently, CYP something, right? Do you think that her detoxification, that's what the cytochrome P450 system is, it's to do with your liver and how you detoxify chemicals, hormones, everything, caffeine, alcohol, medications. Do you think that potentially she could have a mutation or a variant of one of those cytochrome P450 genes that would make her clear out progesterone faster than, let's say, someone else or a group of women that, doing a little study or something, 10, 15, 25 women, and maybe hers clears out faster than the rest.
You know, with the genetics, that would tell us a little bit more about how she processes the hormones because that has to go through the phase two. There's phase one and phase two detoxification. What I was looking at was more about the estrogen metabolism with the CYP.
For the newsletter.
When I was mm-hmm. looking and, writing about the newsletter, that's more about the estrogen clearing out of the system, which is always good to get your genetic test to be able to see if you're if you make a lot of estrogen, if you can clear it out fast, if you turn your estrogen when you're using estrogen, it's not the issue, it's the metabolites. So your estrogen has to go through your liver and it has to be detoxified. Mm-hmm. So MTHFR actually will lower your detoxification of estrogen for the phase two metabolism. Mm-hmm. So that's why you can have hormonal imbalances with MTHFR. The CYP, there's like a 1A SNP, so CYP1A, CYP1A17, I think it is, and then a CYP like 1B. So those three tell us about their estrogen metabolites. Am I making everybody bored?
No, the dog just moved over there and he bumped into the camera. So it was probably, I saw it wiggling over there. He didn't pay attention to the camera in his way. Thanks, Bob.
Thanks, bud.
I'm sorry. I cut you off. I see it moving and it caught my attention.
Yeah, I was just saying that, when you're detoxifying your estrogen, we want to push it towards 2-hydroxyestrogen. 2-hydroxy mm-hmm. is good. 4-hydroxy, not good. And any of you that have had a Dutch test, the urine test, let us know, because we can talk about that, because that actually has the estrogen metabolites in there. You can't test it through blood. You can just do it with the genetics in the urine.
Yeah, no, the Dutch test is very popular these days. And I think that part you're talking about, that methylation and looking at those metabolites, it gives you a nice little graph, green, yellow, green, red, or blue, mm-hmm. Right? So green is for the 2-hydroxy. What do you keep looking
at? Looking over there. I'm also sitting here, so I want to see what the camera sees.
I'm going to have to turn that.
I can see my arm.
I'm going to have to turn that because you're going to keep looking at it.
All right. Yeah. Maybe put a cover over it.
Yeah, because you're just looking at that the whole time.
Yeah.
Is it distracting?
It's a little bit distracting.
Yeah.
It's like watching TV.
Well, see, I'm facing you and there's no monitor over here. So you're sort of, I have it here. So when we're getting everything set up, but now you're looking this way. You're looking at that camera and it's like right in your line of sight.
Well, maybe the next podcast, you sit here and I sit there.
We can try that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can try that.
Oh, just to see.
Yeah, absolutely. No problem. But I could see where, because I can see it switching in the corner of my eye. So I could see where it's like your eyes want to gravitate towards it.
I know.
It's wild. So a little bit of a side tangent. So I don't know what SNP or what cytochrome P450 enzyme metabolizes progesterone. That's something I'll have to look that up. I'm not off the top of my head.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I would imagine that, you know, based on maybe clearance of caffeine, clearance of alcohol, different things like that, that's sort of how you just ask people a couple of questions, like on an intake. How do you tolerate alcohol? How do you tolerate caffeine? You don't tolerate those things very well. Now you know that phase one detoxification, that cytochrome P450 system is, wouldn't say sluggish necessarily, but you know, for some people, they can tolerate tons of alcohol, tons of caffeine, and it doesn't slow them down. They'd be sort of like more in that fast oxidizer sort of realm, where maybe she's a little bit more that way because she's clearing that progesterone out quickly. But like you said, it's just a timing issue, 8:30 at night till 12:30 the next day. If she went right when the labs opens, taken at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, as late as you can the night before, and getting to the lab as early you can the following morning, I bet you that number would be pretty good. You're still checking yourself over there.
I keep bumping it.
Yeah. Anything else to add about that? It was just a little bit about the genetics and liver function. And, you know, I just thought I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
I think we need to add that we're starting and launching a community.
Yes. So today is actually August 2nd, the day of this recording. This is going to probably go out next week. So the week of August 4th, well, August 4th is a Monday. Our community is going to be launching on August 11th. So our business, or this podcast, the Progressure Health podcast, our business is Progressure Health. We're launching the Progressure Hormones community. And it is going to be sort of an extension of what we're already doing, answer these kinds of questions, giving women a place to congregate and kind of further the conversation, because there's so much that we can't cover on the podcast. Mm-hmm. There's so much that we can, I'm sure even says she's got so many questions, right?
Oh, you know, yeah. And a lot of these women, you know, menopause and perimenopause can be very isolating because it's hard to find the answers. Sometimes your doctor doesn't know everything, or maybe your doctor doesn't have time to go over everything with you.
Doctors are busy.
And then, you know, I've got people that just get blown off by their doctors or by their family members or by people around them, that it can be kind of lonely trying to do it on your own. So that's why we always wanted, in fact, I've been wanting to do some kind of community in my head. I just couldn't picture it for probably 15 years as a way for women to come together so that we can, you know, support each other, communicate, mm-hmm. and then not have, you know, actually have like real answers and real discussion. So we don't all have to do this alone.
Yeah. So this video won't be necessarily as evergreen because we're putting some dates in there. But the date, August 11th, if you're seeing this way after August 11th, then just go to progressionhormones.com. You'll see the website. I think it's going to be amazing. I'm really excited about it. It's a lot of work getting it launched, a little bit nerve wracking. We're like 9 days away. We still got a bunch of things to do, but I think it'll be, so the first group that's coming in on the 11th, literally founding members, we're going to we're not building it from scratch per se, but we're sort of building it from, it's going to be a kind of a minimum viable product. And we're going to, the group of women that are in there to start out are going to sort of help us build it, create it. Mm-hmm. So we do what sort of women collectively want in a community like that, which I think is really exciting. There's lots. I mean, bones and brain health and heart health and all the different things kind of congregated, you know, with that common theme of hormones and how we, you know, how we collectively increase our health span, increase our lifespan, and we're set up for success in the future. So anything else to add about the community or about Kendra's question?
Nope, this was great. No, and I appreciate Kendra for writing. I appreciate everybody for writing into us and subscribing and everything. So it's been great.
Yeah, so in the comments down below, if you're watching this on YouTube, you can write whatever you want down there. You can go to our website, Ask the Doctor. The link for the hormone community or the Progress Your Hormone Community landing page will be in the description below. It'll just take you to the wait list. If you're catching this after the fact, it might just be, you know, maybe just the actual Progress Your Hormones itself. But if you're catching this in the next coming week, it'll take you right to the community wait list. And we hope to see you on the inside. So until next time, I'm Dr. Mackey.
And I'm Dr. Valerie.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Take care.